Mr. Preble, are you ready?
Ready to go. All set?
The floor is yours.
Merci, monsieur. And now that I have it, I'm not going to give it up. So, today we are going to have a recap of what has been happening with the Omnibus Habitat Amendment. And as always, for those of you who have been here long enough to remember my last presentation, it's behind tab 7. And I will be spending a bit of time on item number 2. This habitat amendment probably ranks as the longest amendment in the history of the council. If not the longest, it's right up there with the top, and I think it probably is the longest. Tom can probably tell me if we've hit the record, like Brady with his passing. At any rate, it started in 2004, 7 years ago. And there are very few people on the council today who were there then or have a memory of how all of this evolved. So for those of you to whom it probably seems like a confused mess, I'm going to take a couple of minutes to go back over where we've been and how we got to where we are. First of all, the whole issue of protecting habitat really began with the 1996 reauthorization of the Magnuson Act, known as the Sustainable Fisheries Act. The SFA required the protection of essential fish habitat, which is our current mandate. And it specified exactly what that meant. Essential fish habitat was defined as those waters and substrates necessary to fish for spawning, feeding, breeding, or growth to maturity. And it further required that FMPs created under this authority had to describe and identify EFH, or essential fish habitat, in text that clearly states the habitats or site types of habitats determined to be EFH for each of the 4 recognized life stages of all of the managed species. So by itself, that was a substantial task. But it went further, because it said that we had 3 things to consider. One was that we had to evaluate the potential, all potential adverse effects of fishing on EFH designated, including the effects of each fishing activity regulated under the FMP or other federal FMPs. It said that we had to assess past management actions and minimize the potential adverse effects of past actions on EFH. It also required that we analyze the cumulative effects of multiple fishing activities on EFH, not just one single activity, but everything that was done. And we had to initiate habitat areas of particular concern and research closed areas. I want to make that clear because there's been some discussion about that recently. It further went on to say that we had to minimize adverse effects. Minimize to the extent practicable adverse effects on EFH caused by fishing, and to identify a range of potential new actions that could be taken to address adverse effects on EFH, including an analysis of the practicability and adopt any new measures that are necessary and practicable. And it went on and it explained what it meant by practicability. And as some of you may or may not remember, there was a subsequent lawsuit against the agency for failing to live up to that, which the agency lost. So this is our current mandate. In 1998, the first EFH omnibus amendment was put into effect. And then in 2004, Omnibus Amendment 2, the one that we're working on now, was begun. Under the Omnibus Amendment, the first thing that was created was a list of goals and objectives. And those goals and objectives are in your packet as item number 2. And I think that since it's been so long since anybody's looked at them, most anybody, that I'd like to take a few minutes here and go over what these goals and objectives are and how they relate to what we do today, because what we do today is directly a result of those goals and objectives, and those goals and objectives are a direct result of the current legal mandate that we're under to protect EFH. So I'd like to get that up on our screen. Okay, the first goal was to redefine, refine, or update the identification and description of all EFH for those species of finfish and mollusks managed by the Council, including the consideration of HAPs. That was the first goal. The second one, identify, review, and update the major fishing activities, MSA and non-MSA, that may adversely affect the EFH of those species managed by the Council. Third, identify, review, and update the major non-fishing activities that may adversely affect the EFH of those species managed by the Council. And then the fourth one is interesting. It says, identify and implement mechanisms to protect, conserve, and enhance the EFH of those species managed by the Council to the extent practicable. The fifth one, define metrics for achieving the requirements to minimize adverse effects to the extent practicable. It's important to note that when this was written originally, there were no metrics in existence to do this job. There was no tool in existence to get this done. The sixth one, to integrate and optimize measures to minimize the adverse impacts of EFH across all council-managed FMPs. All council-managed FMPs. And number seven was to update research and information needs. And number eight was to review and update prey species information. Now, from those goals, let me go through the last one first of all. Since this, in red, is a new one that was put into effect several years later, so let me just go over that now. I was going to go back to it, but let me just go over it now. Later, around 2006, 2007, we were charged also as a goal in all of this to protect deep sea corals and their habitats throughout the Northeast region from fishing impacts. And that's in red because it was one that was added to what was already a monumental task. It added this at a later date. From these general goals, which don't tell us how to do things, were identified several objectives. And I'd like to go through those because this is what we're trying to do. First one, identify new data sources and assimilate into the process to meet goals, state, federal, and other data sources. So we had to go through all of the existing data sources on habitat. B, implement review of existing HAPCs and consider modified or additional HAPCs. The third one, C, review EFH designations and refine or redefine where appropriate as improved data and analysis become available. Those three together form a block which was related to our mandate to identify essential fish habitat. And then we go on into the block that is part of the second general large goal. D, develop analytical tools for designation of EFH, minimization of adverse impacts, and monitoring the effectiveness of measures designed to protect habitat. Now understand that at the time this goal was written, no such tools existed. There was no metric, there was no matrix, there was nothing available. We can read it now. There was nothing available to actually do this job. E, modify fishing methods and create incentives to reduce the impacts on habitat associated with fishing. F, support restoration and rehabilitation of fish habitats which have already been degraded by fishing and non-fishing activities. G, support creation and development of fish habitat where appropriate and when increased fishery resources would benefit society. H, develop a strategy for prioritizing habitat protection. I, develop criteria for establishing and implementing dedicated habitat research areas. J, design a system for monitoring and evaluating the benefits of EFH management activity actions, including dedicated habitat research areas. These related to Goal 7, and I wanted to bring these out particularly because I know I myself have been criticized recently, and some of the people that have been working on it have been criticized for bringing too much of an emphasis on research into this, but it was an original part of it. And the original research requirement was specifically so that we could monitor the effects of what we did, something that had never been done before, particularly in this kind of an action. And the then we have the last two, which now are have become necessary. Recently, we've had to add Goal 6 because we had to consider modifications to groundfish rebuilding closures. The reason for that was because the original habitat areas were closely linked to the groundfish closures. Since it, at the beginning, when the first EFH for omnibus habitat was put in, there was no way to judge the effect of even where they should be, the effect of our actions on the habitat, or even where they should be. So they were closely linked to the groundfish actions that were taking place at the time. And then L, using the discretionary provisions established via the 2007 MSA reauthorization, develop deep sea coral protection zones, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So those were the goals and objectives. These goals and objectives divide themselves really into two broad areas that relate to the original mandate. And for that reason, it was decided in 2005 to move this amendment on two separate tracks, one of which would be to identify and define, refine, upgrade the EFH designations. And the second one, which would cover all of the requirements to minimize the effects of fishing and non-fishing activities on recognized habitat. That was in 2005, after this amendment had first started. And that action was taken, and it was two-tracked. There were, at that time, developed a set of objectives for each of the two tracks, but it's important to recognize that those objectives were not the original objectives. They were ancillary objectives, so the whole thing was becoming very complicated. In 2006, it was decided to add corals to this, but the only way that it could be done under the 1996 action, Sustainable Fisheries Act, was to only consider corals where they were in some area that was already EFH for a managed species, because that's the way the law read. So there was this sort of dishonest way of trying to move corals in by saying, well, we can protect corals here or there as long as it's EFH for some species we manage, because we don't manage corals. That was really a kind of a sleazy way of doing it, although it was the only way it was available at the time. The 2007 Magnuson reauthorization changed that. It gave a separate discretionary authority outside of the EFH requirement, and we were tasked with that job as well, and we are currently working on that. So the first track was essentially completed. The EFH designation was essentially completed, and in 2006 we began developing a tool to do the analytical portion that was required for the other track, the effects minimization. And this, I want to emphasize that this whole Sassy Lisa thing that took so much time was an integral part of what was required under the law at that time. It still is part of our legal mandate. The job snowballed because nobody at the time had an appreciation for how complex it really is to analyze the bottom that you can't see with data that most of which you don't have to try to come up with a metric that will give you a reasonable answer. It was a long job. It took 4 years to complete it, and it was the swept area seabed interaction model, which SASI for short, and that was further refined into the LISA analysis. It went through several reviews by the SSC, and finally it was decided that since it was cutting edge, it would have to be put out to an independent peer review. Now we're up to 2010. The final peer review was done in February of 2011. During that year in between, it was decided not to work any further on effects minimization until we had the peer review. It would not make sense to set up an entire set of alternatives only to find out that there were fundamental flaws in SASE, only revealed by the peer review. So we're dead in the water until that was completed. And that was completed in February. The report came out in April. So in April of 2011, we essentially started work on the alternatives. So this is the story of how it got stretched out for as long as it did. And now we've essentially been working on the alternatives since April of this year, and it's now November. And during that time, we also realized that we were going to have to take into account the groundfish closed areas, and at the same time, we had Amendment 16 with an all-new way of managing groundfish. So there were fundamental and profound changes being taken that impacted the entire omnibus habitat amendment as they impacted the entire ground fishery. Now we're in a situation where the whole thing is finally starting to come together. And we find that the time is particularly propitious and, in fact, is running out for a number of reasons. So now what we need to do is to use the SASE model, which is now the best available science, and develop our alternatives. SASE is a done deal. It's been peer-reviewed. It's now being used in other areas. And, in fact, NAFO is even adapting now, in the process of adapting the SASE model to use in the NAFO regulatory area in the western North Atlantic outside of the 200-mile limits of the countries. And it will be basically the format for assessing environmental impacts of fishing all the way from essentially Cape Hatteras to Greenland. It's a profound move forward. It was a triumph for the New England Fishery Management Council, and particularly for the Habitat PDT, who did an absolutely magnificent job on this piece of work. But now it's there, it's done. We don't need to talk about the model itself. But today I would like to have Michelle go through where we're moving with SASE and what we need to do. But before she does that, I wanted to make sure that everybody was up to date on where we came from in this and where we must go. SASE has shown us, first of all, that we have to do two things. We have to protect what we now know are the actual high vulnerability, long recovery time areas. It has also shown us that the areas we've been protected are in the wrong place. Not surprising, since it was pretty much random when it was done. If it's bottom, it must be habitat. Well, now we know that what we did 12, 14 years ago had a lot of problems. So we know that we have to protect these high vulnerability areas, and we also know that we have to reduce the amount of bottom time of fishing gear. And the best way to do that is to fit right in with the groundfish action. And instead of managing to decrease efficiency, which is what input controls did, we have to reverse that. We have to go exactly the other way, because SASE has shown us that the best way to minimize impact on the bottom is to increase the efficiency of the fishing gear, increase the catch per unit effort. Now, I'd like to recognize Mark Gibson here. He was the one that first teased that out of the data and made a big point of it and brought everybody else on board with it. He was exactly right. It was about 2 years ago that Mark first said that. We get the best bang for the buck on protecting habitat by doing exactly what we have to do in the ground fishery. We have to increase CPUA, get the right tax, get the boats out there, get it done quick, get them off the bottom. That's how you protect habitat. And in addition to that, you protect your high completely protect your high vulnerability, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, areas. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Michelle, and she'll carry it on.
Thanks, Dave. So he stole my thunder in kind of a couple of areas, so I'm going to try not to be too redundant here. I wanted to try and bring us up to speed about where the committee and the PDT are now, but I just wanted to step back a little bit because some new council members weren't around for the development of SASE, so I wanted to just kind of boil it down. If you're looking at your presentation, basically this list and then the schematic are the same thing, so I'll kind of just go through the schematic. So there's a few different components that go into SASE and that we developed kind of as standalone pieces. And the first, up in the top right there in red, sorry if you're red-green colorblind and these colors bother you, the vulnerability assessment. And so what we did with that was look at different phishing gear types and think about how they interacted with the seabed, with actually specific either substrate types in the seabed or benthic organisms. And we made an assessment based on the literature where we could or based on just our best professional judgment where we couldn't about how vulnerable different features were to different gear types. And then the phishing effort from those gear types starting in 1996 and through the present was characterized as an area swept, which was a pretty straightforward exercise for something like a trawl or a dredge. Was a little bit more challenging for something like a fixed gear. We made a lot of assumptions. But in any case, the goal was to put everything on the same footing so that we could do the kind of cumulative effects assessment and, you know, comparing across plans and trying to optimize across plans that Dave was referring to earlier. And then finally, we developed kind of a spatial grid of where different habitat types are, and we basically characterized habitat by its substrate and whether it was a high or low energy environment. And so when you combine all of those into the SASE model, which, you know, looks really simple up there and just a little gray arrow, but took Chad a long time to get running in a way that was efficient and elegant and went through a couple of iterations. But basically, when you put together the vulnerability estimates and the phishing effort data and the habitat distribution information, what you get, there's a figure on the next page that I'll show you, but it's basically a spatially specific distribution of which areas are more vulnerable to different types of phishing. And so we used those basic outputs as kind of the core of our as we were starting to figure out how to develop alternatives to minimize the adverse effects of different fisheries. And so once we had those basic outputs, we needed to kind of figure out a way to look at them. And, you know, just simply looking, I guess I'll skip ahead. The figure on the left is it's kind of a cropped, but it's really the area that we've been focusing on in terms of the adverse effects alternative. So it's kind of why it's zoomed into there. So that's the trawl gear simulated, what's called Z is the output of SASE. And so the darker the red areas are the more vulnerable areas, and then the blue are the less vulnerable areas according to the model. And so that you can kind of see how the left panel and then the center panel are really similar. But the center panel really, it looks at each of the squares in SASE, and each of those grid cells are 10 kilometers on a side, so they're pretty small. And it compares each square to the squares that are adjacent to it. And when you actually have clusters of high vulnerability squares, that's what pops out. And in terms of, you know, being practical or practicable from a management standpoint, what you would want to look at are clusters. You're not going to want to be trying to protect individual 10 by 10 kilometer squares. So that's why we took this additional step of trying to figure out where the high vulnerability area is clustered. And so then what the PDT did with those clusters was we said, okay, well, let's look at each of them and figure out, you know, which ones do we think are real, which ones do we think, you know, are somewhat artificial in either, you know, their size or their location, based on what we know about the bottom types. In some cases, you know, some parts of our area, like Georges Bank, for example, we have much higher resolution of the habitat type data. And other areas in the Gulf of Maine, for example, we don't know quite as much about the distribution of the particularly vulnerable substrates, being the boulders and the cobbles and things. So we kind of took those clusters as a starting point and the other information we had and just the knowledge of the members of the PDT, and what we came out with were a list of vulnerable habitat areas that we brought to the committee. And so I think those are probably actually a little easier to see on the right-hand panel, I just put a kind of an asterisk on the center of each of those areas, but they're on the LISA cluster panel as well. And so you can kind of see how they line up with some of the current management areas, and there's some agreement between the areas that the PDT recommended, you know, that the committee take a look at for adverse effects alternatives, and then there are some areas that don't line up so well with our current areas. And Dave kind of went through this as well, but just to reiterate, you know, the two, and it may be a little bit, you know, circular, because one of the, you know, premises of SASE was that the amount of area swept that you have going into the model is kind of your maximum habitat impact as a starting point, and then that's maybe reduced if the habitat's more or less vulnerable by, you know, a certain proportion. So obviously an outcome of the model is going to be related to the total amount of area swept. But I think it's pretty intuitive, the second bullet, that if you spend less time with fishing gear contacting the bottom, that you're going to have less of a habitat impact. And, you know, to the extent that our estimates of area swept that we put into the SASE model are accurate, what we can do with the model now that we maybe couldn't do before, we can kind of take this intuition into something that you can actually quantify. So I think that's kind of nice. And so as we go forward and take these specific areas and try and make some projections about which ones would go together and how that might affect fishing effort, we can actually come out with some, you know, kind of quantitative estimates of how the different options compare when you combine them. And then the other kind of major conclusion that we probably could have guessed, you know, ahead of time, and we've gotten some feedback from people that, well, yeah, of course, you know, we could have told you where some of these areas were before you even went through this whole exercise. And we were kind of validating people's, you know, local knowledge, but basically there, you know, a lot of these vulnerable places do kind of cluster, and so that really lends itself to spatial management in addition to this kind of strategy of just trying to reduce area swept. And as I mentioned, you know, these vulnerable clusters, what we estimated is that they're centered on kind of cobble and boulder substrates, and those are, you know, clustered across the region, so that's why you see these clusters. So there's kind of inherent in all of the management alternatives that we've been developing at the committee and with the PDT is kind of these two premises, that we're protecting these vulnerable clusters and that we're also trying to increase some flexibility that allows people to reduce their area swept. And so those are kind of themes that are going to, I think, come up as we move forward in this process and really start to talk about the actual details of these different management options that are being proposed. And so just finally, Dave already mentioned this as well, but the council voted in April to fold consideration of eliminating changing the year-round groundfish closures into the omnibus amendment, recognizing kind of the overlap spatially between our current habitat areas and the current groundfish areas. So the PDT and committee have been working on options to minimize adverse effects of fishing on habitat with kind of the CPUE considerations and the protecting the most vulnerable spots in mind. But obviously habitat concerns, you know, are not the only thing that's going on in the ocean. And so ultimately the options that come out of the amendment, that the sets of alternatives that go forward are going to be driven by multiple objectives. And some of those, you know, haven't really been defined yet. And so we're kind of at the stage in the process where I guess we're trying to figure that out. And so basically in order to create something that's holistic and hopefully efficient, and because these different areas are going to overlap or not overlap in different ways, kind of the next step here is to bring the Groundfish Committee and the Groundfish Plan Development Team into the process and get them to start to figure out what the objectives are from a groundfish perspective, and then we're going to need to try and integrate them with habitat objectives in hopefully a way that ends up with something that either everybody hates equally or likes equally or something. And I think this discussion is going to be continued tomorrow during priorities, so I don't know if anybody wants to ask any questions or has any thoughts for now, but that's all I've got. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'd like to have you move back to number nine for a moment. Okay, it's important to note here on the right-hand side that the LISA clusters that tell us where we have clustered area of high vulnerability and long recovery times are not where the current closures are for the most part, not completely, as Michelle pointed out. But if you look at the Nantucket Lightship closed area, closed area 1, closed area 2, and large parts of the Western Gulf of Maine closed area, these do not show up on the LISA analysis as being areas of high vulnerability that require a large amount of protection, while other areas, the northern part of Georges Bank, the western side of Great South Channel, do show up. So these are changes that need to be made in order to properly manage habitat. But at the same time, they're groundfish closed areas. So we need to consider both at the same time. We can't be in the position of just closing new areas and opening for habitat but still having them closed for another reason, unless the other reason is valid. So that's what we need to determine, and that's why now we're going to be working with groundfish on doing that. And the time is really propitious. It is time to reform the closed areas because we've gone to quota management, we've gone to output controls, and it's just not appropriate under output controls, quota management, it's not appropriate to continue managing by reducing efficiency. So if we do reform these closed areas and we find areas of agreement where we can get them completely open, we will increase the cash per unit area. We will increase fleet diversity by allowing, particularly in the Western Gulf of Maine, small boats access to areas that are currently closed. We will increase individual efficiency of businesses, and we will reduce the bottom contact of the gear throughout all of the habitat of the continental shelf. Those are all important things to be finishing up and working on. We also found out at the meeting a couple of weeks ago that Annie gave the report on earlier that all of the sector managers are stressing this as being very important to get done as quickly as possible. We have a whole bundle of letters that we've received that say that now is the time, let's get it done. And also in your packet there are letters from Dr. Lubchenco as well as Senator Kerry and responses from this body that say the same thing. So it's time to move, put this to bed, get it done. And that's the end of my report.
Questions? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just a clarification. With the figure that's on the screen, the one on the left, red is more vulnerable and blue is less vulnerable, as indicated on the figure. Then we go to the LISA clusters, and the asterisk means the most vulnerable areas, right? It's the most vulnerable, not just vulnerable, but most, because I go to the schematic where it shows that LISA analysis, the output predicts the most vulnerable adverse effects. I'm just trying to clarify terms and colors and shapes. So the asterisks would be the most vulnerable areas.
Yeah,
You mentioned that the asterisk, I think, represents the middle of an area that would be called most vulnerable. So how big are the areas around the asterisk? I'm having difficulty relating to the meaning of the asterisk.
Yeah, I actually just sent myself an email to think about a different way to represent this because I think I could have done a better job. But what I kind of wanted to steer away from was putting up potential management areas that are very draft. And so there was essentially kind of three steps that we went through. We developed the left panel and came up with the output where, yes, you're correct, the redder colors are the most vulnerable. And so those are essentially percentiles, the different colors on the ramp there. And then the LISA clusters are it's hard to see, but there's two different thresholds. There's of kind of percentiles. They're not really significance values, but if it met the criteria of being one of the highest vulnerability squares, and it was close by to other high vulnerability squares. That's when it clustered under Leeson. So the kind of clumped shapes that are, you know, aggregations of the different squares, those are the LISA clusters themselves. And then the areas with the asterisks, the PDT kind of went a step beyond the LISA clusters, and we said, okay, you know, the Platts Bank cluster, for example, which is, I mean, everybody knows where Platts Bank is, I guess. Platts Bank isn't actually that large. And so we sat there and said, okay, well, let's explore why the cluster looks like that, and let's make some suggestions for the committee about what's probably a better looking start at a management area for Platts Bank if they wanted to have one. There were some other areas that didn't really cluster, you know, due to lack of data. One of the asterisks is on top of, it's kind of centered on Cash's Ledge. We know that Cash's Ledge is a vulnerable habitat. We didn't really have the sampling points there for it to cluster in the LISA analysis. And so the PDT said, all right, cluster analysis aside, that's a vulnerable area. And so the stars on the map are basically going from the LISA clusters, incorporating additional information and knowledge, and making a recommendation about cluster areas and non-cluster areas. Here's everything that we think is important that you should take a look at.
Okay, I'm still
those have evolved into management alternatives.
Okay, I'm still not getting it. The LISA clusters, the areas that are most vulnerable, those would be the deeper red and the lighter red areas labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, and
right,
5,
yeah.
and 6. But those are the LISA clusters.
Yep.
They're the most vulnerable areas based on SASE.
According to SASE, right.
Okay. All right. Now we jump from that middle figure to the third figure, and here's where I get a little bit lost, because no longer do we see the areas 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We see just the asterisks.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out what the asterisks mean relative to what we might want to consider doing in the future regarding changing area closures.
Right.
So how do I interpret the third figure in those specific asterisks?
Yeah, it probably would have been better if I'd actually just put up the polygons of vulnerable areas that the PDT recommended, and I can send that to you just for your clarification. For example, if you take the LISA cluster 1, it's up the northernmost cluster. There's a bunch of, you know, near shore kind of rocky habitats in the Gulf of Maine. You can see there's kind of two clusters that straddle the 3 nautical mile limit. The PDT discussed those areas, and we made the assessment there are probably many other areas with similar habitat types along the coast of the Gulf of Maine. Those areas kind of clustered the way they did because of where they fell along the boundary of this domain of the SASE model. And so we said, we don't think those clusters are particularly useful as management areas for habitat purposes. Even though they clustered, we don't recommend that you look at them further as management areas. Whereas we said, you know, Cache's Ledge, Fippenese Ledge didn't cluster, but we think that those are potentially important for you to consider as management areas, and we know that they have the same types of boulder and hard bottom habitat in some of the areas that did cluster. And so we kind of went through a refining process where we threw out some of the clusters and added some additional areas, and those were the vulnerable areas that we brought to the committee for them to kind of continue development on.
Okay,
maybe Dave can make this clearer than I am.
Yeah, okay, I'll talk to you more about this offline, Michelle. Thank
okay.
you. The major conclusions of SASE, the slide after the one that's up there, focuses, as I suspect it would, on locations where cobble and boulder substrates are frequently encountered. Could you give us a brief summary as to what the implications are of SASE for bottoms that are mud? In other words, are we going in a direction where we, the council, will be advised that we need not be concerned about areas that are primarily mud, deep water mud, for example?
Yeah, I'd say that based on the way that the PDT is, you know, partly based on how we maybe develop the vulnerability assessment itself, but then our read on the outcomes of the model, or that the areas that, you know, we think are most vulnerable are those boulder and cobble habitats and not so much the deep water mud habitats. And it's partly related to, and, you know, to some extent, there's error associated with the SASE outputs. I mean, it's kind of an arbitrary output in terms of kilometer squared anyway, but what goes into those outputs is a kind of guess about the types of features, the types of either, you know, a pile of boulders or sponges or other types of things that make up that habitat type. And so in aggregate, when we assessed how fishing gears interact with those individual structural bits and features of the sea bottom, the seabed, what we found when we ran it through the model was that if we kind of assume an equal distribution of all the different types of things that would occur in boulder and cobble versus the types of things that occur in a mud bottom, the mud bottomed features are just less vulnerable to different types of fishing gear than the types of things you would find in a boulder environment. So yeah, I think that's a fair assessment that we wouldn't recommend measures for deep mud.
Dave, probably you have some clarification.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, now SASE is, has been peer reviewed. We really don't want to get into SASE today, the structure of SASE. It's a highly complex model. It requires a lot of computer time. It's got absolutely enormous amount of data. But as far as these clusters came up, are concerned, SASE shows us on 10-minute squares areas of vulnerability. We're not going to be managing 10-minute squares. We know that. So what was brought up was the way that was handled was with the LISA analysis. And I don't want to get into this because it's all been peer-reviewed. But the way the computer model worked is it zipped across these squares, thousands of squares, one at a time, analyzing not just the square but all the squares around it and giving a numerical average for each individual square on what its vulnerability was based upon not just that square but all the stuff around it. And then the whole model was run 10,000 times to generate the analyses. We've got all that data. If I can get it to you. And the procedure that was used. And Chad and Brad did most of the work on this. But what it did was it generated, SASE told us where the vulnerability was, but it doesn't tell us how to manage. That's something I believe you and I spoke about some time ago, Dr. Pierce, was that that SASE isn't going to tell us, well, do this, do that. It tells us what's out there, and then we make the decision. And that's what has been decided on here. I'm not sure about the asterisks. That's not really what we came up with the LISA analysis, came up with the clusters. And the clusters were 10,000 repetitions of that zipping across all of them, doing each one and all the ones around it and with a modifier so that we could come up with these manageable type areas with some real analysis of what needed to be protected. And obviously you're not going to take a place with a few boulders and a little bunch of gravel and say, well, we're going to have a management action there. SASE could tell us that, but that wasn't useful. So that's what the LISA analysis is all about. But all of that stuff, there's just stacks and stacks of data, and you're welcome to see any part of it.
Something that we actually kind of came up in the context of coral areas, which we've been spending a lot of time on lately and I haven't really touched on at all today, was that so we know that a lot of these corals that are the larger, kind of more sexy corals or whatever have you, that we really would want to be protecting are on hard bottom, probably in canyons, on seamounts, and things like that. Any management area that you're going to draw to protect hard bottom in a canyon is going to encompass other bottom types as well, mud, sand, because the hard bottomed areas are kind of relatively rare and very localized and kind of in this larger matrix of sand and mud. And so I think as we move forward and are trying to design exactly, you know, the areas that we want to, either for corals or, you know, areas in the Gulf of Maine or on Georgia's Bank, kind of on the shelf, one thing that, you know, we can consider is, you know, what's the core of the area and what are we, you know, the objective is to protect hard bottom, but there's areas that surround that are, you know, deep mud and things like that. And any of the areas, I would think, in the Gulf of Maine, you know, if you try and draw anything that's a polygon with a reasonably small number of sides, you're going to protect different habitat types. And, you know, as a kind of precautionary, kind of conservative approach, because obviously SASE does not know everything and have all the answers, that might be a useful strategy. So.
Mark.
I have a question. I don't know whether I should direct this to Michelle or Dave, but if you look at slide number 8, the one before that, you can see that the SASE model results and the subsequent LISA analysis are a function of three things, one of those being fishing effort, so that if we form new protected areas that we close to fishing or reduce fishing in, you're ultimately going to displace effort to other areas. And because of that displacement, and because the SASE results are in part a function of effort, it's going to elevate the SASE scores for different areas. And I almost see this becoming either, you know, an iterative or an adaptive process that we sort of have to chase effort around as we go down the road. I'm having a little trouble seeing where this is going to go. So.
Yeah, that analysis has been done. I'd be glad to show it to you. Chad and Brad did was they took all of the areas and ran another analysis on what would happen if effort was displaced out of there, because we know what the Z change would be, and was moved to someplace else. Would that result in a net increase or decrease of Z? And then they ran it all through a numerical analysis of its relative merits, and it covers a couple of volumes, but it's all been done. And in fact, I have a piece of it here that I'll show you afterwards. But it's a good point you make. And that has to be part of the analysis.
Dr. Jim.
Yeah, thanks. Just a question about that figure that had the three things with LISA and the management areas. I was thinking about the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary, if you could comment on that, because for the LISA clusters, there are no red squares where that is. But on the right, it shows two asterisks and a hatched region. So, again, I guess it's sort of the same confusion that Dr. Pierce had about the meaning of the asterisks. So maybe when you present it again, a better presentation would help eliminate questions like that. But the message I get from that is that Stellwagen Bank wouldn't be important under LISA, whereas it's an important, people think of it as an important area.
Yeah, the PDT has definitely discussed that it is an important area, and that it, in terms of encompassing boulder reef, kind of complex habitat types, that it definitely meets the criteria, and that's why we identified it as a vulnerable area. The reason it doesn't cluster in LISA, and the reason that the left-hand panel, again, something I could have made clearer. You know, you don't realize how unclear your presentation is until you bring it to the council, I guess. That left-hand panel, all the fishing effort, it's kind of artificial. It's the same amount of effort in every square. And so it's trying to show you the underlying theoretical habitat vulnerability. So you don't have redder areas because there's more fishing effort there. It's simply a function of what we think we understand about the underlying habitat. There's kind of two forms of SASE, one that actually considers concentrations of fishing effort, and then the other that's uniform. But for Stellwagen, there's actually a ton of data for Stellwagen, and a lot of it is from the U.S. seabed data set, and that data set really doesn't have very much data at all on cobble and boulder. It's biased towards mud and sand. And so essentially, even though we had, you know, some video observations of boulder and cobble habitat in Stellwagen. They kind of end up swamped by the large number of sand and mud samples in the US seabed data set, and just the way that the base grid was drawn, it considers each individual substrate data point individually. And so we've actually, at the PDT, spent a lot of time talking with, you know, between ourselves and then also with the Stellwagen staff about the fact that, you know, in theory, it's the right kind of habitat there. Why doesn't it cluster in SASE? And so that's kind of why we went from LISA clusters to this set of vulnerable areas that we recommended that aren't really well represented here, because we, you know, problems just like that with Stellwagen, knowing that the model just didn't resolve that area properly. So.
Any other question? Sally.
Yeah, so I have a question on process, and I don't know if you want to talk about that now or if we're going to talk about it tomorrow during priority setting.
We could talk a little bit about it now.
Okay. All right, so the very simple question is that's come up at the Habitat Committee, the Groundfish Committee, at the Executive Committee, is how do we deal with the groundfish questions and the habitat questions that are now overlapping. And there's been discussion that was reported in the Executive Committee report most recently about the idea of having the two PDTs come together and provide advice to the council on how to proceed. So, you know, we've gone through these really complicated analyses that, quite frankly, I think the council doesn't have a firm enough grasp on, myself included, to be able to make management decisions that have gotten kind of exponentially more complicated by having added the groundfish measures to the habitat amendment. So the question is, and I think it's still unclear what action is going to be taken, even though we've had this discussion about how to have the technical advice be provided to the council in a way that people can feel comfortable with decision making on the habitat and the groundfish front. In a way that we can actually get this thing done. So I guess my hope is that we can take the good work that the Habitat PDT has done, take the work that the Groundfish PDT is going to do, get them brought together before we're making habitat decisions over here and groundfish decisions over here, bring it together before those decisions are made separately by two different committees. Otherwise, I don't see how it's all going to come together in the end in a way that we have the changes to the groundfish closures and appropriate habitat protections in place in the end. So my hope is that I just need to put that out there because what Michelle has just gone through is really complicated, and it's one piece of it's the technical support for one piece of the decisions that we're going to have to make. You know, Tom is going to be leading more technical advice from the groundfish side of things as we're looking at the year-round groundfish closures. So, you know, as complicated as this is, it's going to get even more complicated when we get the other piece together. So I just want us to be getting ahead of the game in making sure that we're able to actually use the advice that we're getting. And I think my opinion is the best way to do that is to ask our technical advisors to be working together in advance of presenting their analyses to us so that we're clear on what the advice is that we're getting and not feeling like we're getting conflicting advice.
Well, if I can make just a couple of comments on that. One was the and then not that the executive committee's recommendation ends up being the only direction, but that the executive committee recommended that, in fact, the two technical groups do work separately, that they work on their individual areas and come together for reconciling, trading off, I don't know what terms you want to use, and melding the two different things together. It is felt that the two technical committees are not likely to work entirely in vacuums, that they will coordinate some stuff together, that we have one staff person who is on both technical committees. So, the feeling has been that is the most efficient way to move this ahead. Now, my understanding is that tomorrow the Groundfish Committee has a motion to make to the council on the subject. So, essentially, at that point in time, I think that the council is going to have the opportunity to weigh in on that. That will happen subsequent to the priorities discussion, but I don't know that that's hugely problematic. Chris?
I think if I hear you correctly, Sally, you're saying that what you're really concerned about is that the technical committees come together before presentations are made to the council or committees. And I think that's possible. And I think part of the executive committee discussion was simply that the Groundfish PDT needed to get a look at some of the groundfish issues before they could sit down with a habitat PDT and try to work things out. So I'm not sure that that those recommendations are necessarily at odds. You're just saying, I'm just trying to clarify what your recommendation is. You're saying it's easier if this gets, you get a coherent technical presentation. And I think that's still possible under the process the executive committee recommended.
Dave Gaisel.
I think I understand both sides of this discussion, and both sides have merit. As long as the two teams work in consultation with each other, I think initially they can work separately. But, for example, the Groundfish PDT is going to have to know what areas the Habitat PDT has in mind for closures, because a lot of these are new. Use these little asterisks here. They have very high CPUEs in some of these areas, and they're currently open. So they're going to have to analyze the effects of effort shift, you know, back to the closed area model again. So if they don't have those boundaries, I don't see how they can analyze, you know, plug them into the closed area model to analyze where the effort shifts are going to go. You know, some of the areas are in existing closed areas, so there's no net change, really. Those won't be terribly hard to analyze. But the ones that are in areas that are currently open that will close, or areas that are currently closed that will open, present far more challenges from my perspective. And so while I'm not opposed to them working alone initially, as long as they consult with each other, I think they're going to have to work together sooner rather than later. I don't think this can wait till they've both gone pretty far down the road and then have some Uber meeting where they come in and the guy with the biggest hammer walks out the winner. I don't think that's going to work.
Tom?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Dave just said, and I think maybe the one possibility would be not a full-blown commingling, a permanent commingling at the start, but a sort of one or two meetings at the start to share information about where we are now before, you know, before they perhaps kind of go back into their respective corners or groups and work on their own bit of this puzzle. But I do think, for all the reasons that Dave stated, that it might be worthwhile to have these groups come together at the start to get on the same page and share information at the launch of this process. And then just, I believe that this, the commingling would be on the technical analysis at this point itself, and that we'd all have a chance to provide input before we're actually developing specific alternatives. Is that correct? Okay.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're underestimating and second-guessing the professionalism of our staff. They've come to us with a proposal that I think is going to work. I think we need to rely on them to do the job that the good job that they continue to do, and let them cross mingle and pollinate as they see fit. After we set our priorities tomorrow, they're going to know what we need to do, and with if they need more meetings or less meetings, it should be up to them. I don't want to tell them how many times they have to meet and where. I think we're micromanaging them, and it's unnecessary.
Anyone else on this? Mr. Preble.
Yeah, I was basically going to say just about what Terry said. I would not want to dictate to Tom Neese right now how to deal with the groundfish issues. The main thing is that this, from both sides, this is something that needs to be done as soon as possible, and in the priority discussion tomorrow, that's what has to remain at the forefront, is that these are issues that have a bearing on the groundfish management, have a bearing on the quota management system we have right now, and we need to get it done. It's something that's hanging out there that needs to be finished up, and I would just make the case that it needs to be dealt with that way tomorrow morning.
Thanks. Far from it. My suggestion has nothing to do with micromanaging staff. It's a recognition of the committee structure that I think limits the council's ability to sometimes make sensible decisions. And by suggesting that the two committees work together, I mean, there's been a lot of pushback on that, I think in part because that's the way the structure has been for a long time. But the fact is, we've been working on this amendment for almost 9 years. I mean, I chaired the committee for a while, so, I certainly share some of the responsibility for how long this has taken. Dave has, other people, various people have chaired the groundfish committees, but how we get all this done, it's not a matter of staff. It's a matter of how we are stuck. We've been stuck for 8.5 years. So we need to be thinking about ways that we can actually get the job done. I mean, quite frankly, National Marine Fisheries Service has been, I think, very generous in how long they have been giving the council to finish the habitat amendment. The guidelines say that the habitat measure should be updated every 5 years. And we're almost twice that past when the last new EFH designations were put in place. So, this is my comments are no reflection on how the staff gets their job done. It's a commentary on how the council is structured that make it difficult, I think, for us to be able to make good decisions and for the staff to be able to feed in their advice in a way that lets us finally get this thing done.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, we've had some good give and take on this issue. I suggest, Mr. Chairman, we wait until tomorrow on the groundfish to continue this discussion and resolve it, since that is one of the motions that was made and passed by the groundfish committee for consideration by the council.
Are you making a motion to adjourn? Is there a second? Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Thank you, everyone. We're adjourned 8:30 tomorrow morning.